For AZPM, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, the Fox Tucson Theater presents Charlie Chaplin's 1931 classic City Lights with live music by the Tucson Symphony Orchestra. I'll be joined by Maestro Jose Luis Gomez and Fox Theater Executive Director Bonnie Schock to share their enthusiasm for the film and the collaboration. Duncan Moon talks to NPR correspondent Sarah McCammon about her new book based on her own life story. It's called The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Did you enjoy playing sports when you were growing up? Our monthly storytelling segment shares some bittersweet memories of Little League from Tucsonan Steve Braun. Those stories are all next on Arizona Spotlight. When it was released in 1931, the film City Lights was already an odd duck. It starred Charlie Chaplin. It was also produced, directed, written, edited, and scored by him. While talkies had already been around for a couple of years, a film without recorded dialogue now seemed dated and quaint. But Chaplin had an ace up his sleeve, a complete score of sound effects and music that were fully integrated with the action on screen to help tell the whole story. This Saturday, the Fox Tucson Theater will be presenting the film with live accompaniment from the Tucson Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Jose Luis Gomez. Next, I'm joined by Maestro Gomez and the executive director at the Fox Tucson Theater, Bonnie Schock.
This project is the culmination of a series of conversations between the Fox and the Tucson Symphony Orchestra on exciting ways that we may be able to bring our various different strengths together to create a totally unique experience for our audiences. So we are presenting Charlie Chaplin's 1931 silent film classic City Lights. And Chaplin actually wrote the score for this film with all kinds of different sound effects and musical cues. And it is being performed live by the Tucson Symphony Orchestra at the Fox.
Jose Luis, that's where you come in. Tell us about the experience of working from a score that was synchronized to the film back in 1931, and what kind of opportunity or what kind of extra pressures does that bring on the symphony?
What is remarkable here is that Chaplin wrote the music. He was actually a very good musician, played violin. So the music itself helps incredibly the storytelling. The challenges are, like, I think in anything that is accompanying something. That's what I personally took the challenge myself. I never conducted films. This is going to be my first film. Silent film is about maybe like accompanying a ballet because you're following movements. You're following cues that are on the screen. And Chaplin's music lands very well to all those movements. So he thought of that music that, you know, goes very well together with his own actions in the film. And that's really interesting, and I'm very much looking forward to that.
It's incredibly exciting to think about, you know, I'm actually a stage director, and the collaboration between movement and visual storytelling, which of course silent film is sort of a pinnacle of visual storytelling where there's no dialogue, the process of coordinating sound to really convey that emotion and carry the story forward is incredibly dynamic, and it's extremely rare. So this is one of the things I find so exciting about doing this project with the TSO, is that the Fox, as a film palace, sort of original film palace from this exact era, right? The Fox opened in 1930. This film was created in 1931. It's made for that kind of visual experience, and then to have the live orchestra there to carry that story along is really just an incredible artistic experience that we don't get to have anymore.
What about the palette of moods? Because this is obviously a comedy, people who aren't familiar with Chaplin's work may think that's where it stops, but it's actually much deeper than that, isn't it?
It is. This is, I mean, it's a melodrama, like in opera, or maybe in certain operas, if you look at Mozart operas, you know, the famous Da Ponte operas, which are Don Giovanni, Così fan tutte, and Notte di Figaro, those are comedies, but they always have drama. So they call it dramma giocoso. So this is a little bit what Chaplin did too. There is a big, big drama inside, I mean, in story in this movie, but it's still a comedy somehow. That's theater, you know, when you are able to do the most difficult things, make somebody laugh and make somebody cry. And when you're able to do those things at the same time, that's incredibly powerful. And he was a master of that.
Bonnie, what would you like to tell our audience about Chaplin's filmmaking? I would point out that in 1931, the technology to create a talkie movie, as they called them back then, did exist. But Chaplin was a purist and didn't feel comfortable moving into that realm for a little while yet. But he was willing to do the synchronized score and sound effects, which was really pioneering and ahead of its time.
Right. I mean, Chaplin is unquestionably a master. His work is extraordinary. And as Jose said, it's this combination of being able to laugh at ourselves and also find the depth of story. So in this particular story, we have this tramp character that many of us are familiar with as a kind of iconic character in American cinema. He falls in love, and it's a beautiful love story, but it's also a social commentary. It looks really intentionally at class. And Chaplin did that on purpose. You know, he wanted to explore those kinds of issues through laughter and through the true clown, who clowns are able to comment on society by sort of trying things on that don't always fit. And the way that we're then able to laugh at ourselves lets us reveal truths underneath. So and Chaplin was just an absolute master of that. Plus, he also could do a pratfall and all those things that just get at that sort of universal part of our silliness as people. So this film does all of those things all at once.
You mentioned Mozart, Maestro, and I wonder what your ear might have picked out that you think Chaplin might have been thinking about or listening to when he was composing.
Well, definitely it's his own style. It's 1920s, you know, music. There are some blues and can-cans, you know, there's music that is from that time. But the storytelling, it's very operatic when it comes to the music storytelling. So it's very well paced. It's not only to support the action, but to tell the story through the action with the music. And that's what I feel that is more like accompanying music other than just something that is just, you know, background music. No, this is actually helping the whole action to happen. And it's remarkably done. I mean, it's like but of course, he was a musician, so you could tell. It's done from a musician's mind.
Something that always confused me when I was a child and I would see Chaplin is how flexible his cane was. You know, it was really wobbly. Because I would think, well, that's not really usable as a cane. Watching it last night, it hit me. Yeah, it's too flimsy to be a cane. Like, that's the joke.
Right.
It was almost right there in plain sight all this time, and I never quite hit me. But the way he uses his cane as a prop is quite original and, you know, makes me think of the amount of mime and physical theater that is always incorporated in his performances. Yeah. And then one last scene that really stuck with me is he gets to briefly drive this fancy car, kind of a sports car, and he gets the woman seated in the passenger seat, and then he scrambles over her like a dog, you know, like when you take your dog for a drive and they get super excited, you know, he scrambles over the seats to get in the driver's seat, and that was just hilarious to me.
Great comedy is based on exaggeration, right? And there's a certain inherent absurdity to the kind of materialism of great wealth. And so it sets itself up. It is exaggerated, you know, extreme wealth is unexpected in many ways. And so there's so much material there. And that same kind of physical exaggeration of the enthusiasm and excitement of just being able to drive this car, right, takes all of those things on.
Thanks to Bonnie Schock, executive director of the Fox Tucson Theater, and maestro Jose Luis Gomez, conductor of the Tucson Symphony Orchestra. Chaplin's City Lights screens this Saturday, April 20th at 7:30 p.m. Ticket information is at foxtucson.org. In this election year, evangelical Christians are in the news almost daily as an example of an unshakable base of support for former President Donald Trump. But all is not well in the evangelical world, as many in the newest generation of conservative Christian voters are plagued by deep questions about the belief system they have been taught. NPR national political correspondent Sarah McCammon is one of these so-called ex-evangelicals. She grew up in a deeply evangelical family in the Midwest in the 80s and 90s, strictly taught to fear God, obey Him, and never question the faith. Now she's written a book about her journey out of the evangelical fold called The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. AZPM's Duncan Moon spoke with Sarah McCammon about her journey.
You know, the media so often describes evangelicals as some sort of monolith. Can we start with a definition? When you speak of evangelicals, who are you talking about? Is it a religion, a movement? How would you best describe it?
The term evangelical is and has been contested, and I think it's important to acknowledge that. But I define it as theologically and usually politically conservative Protestant Christians, most of whom in the U.S., or at least when we're talking about political movement, tend to be white, although not exclusively. They believe in pretty traditional Christian ideas that Jesus is the Son of God, that Jesus is the only way to heaven, that the Bible is God's word. But there's a real emphasis on evangelization. Sometimes people mix up the words evangelical and evangelist or evangelism, but they're all related words. And the idea is that it's, you know, if you're an evangelical, it's your job to share your beliefs with other people and lead them to the truth with a capital T, because those who do not share those beliefs are ultimately going to be condemned by God. That's what we were taught growing up, and that applied to people of different faiths, of no faith, and it also applied to other types of Christians that we didn't see as having the right kind of theology or having questionable theology. And so that was a huge focus of my church, Christian school, my family, the idea that we needed to proselytize. And with that, there was an idea that we had sort of God's vision for the way the world, the family, the country should be. And so that quickly became and has become increasingly a political project as well as a spiritual and theological one.
How did your exodus from evangelicalism really begin? How did you get from who you were to where you are now?
Sure. I mean, I wrote this book because that was a question I was getting more and more in recent years as I sort of accidentally found myself covering evangelical politics. I had left evangelicalism or had my own kind of complicated relationship with it long before the 2016 election cycle and the rise of Donald Trump. But I was assigned to cover that campaign. I wound up, like so many other reporters, spending a lot of time thinking about and talking to white evangelicals who make up a crucial part of the Republican base and have for a long time, about whether or not they would embrace Trump, who seemed on the surface to be the antithesis of everything they stood for. So I did a lot of stories like that. And then in the course of some of that reporting, I came across other people who were wrestling with this label evangelical and the politics around it and some of the connotations that it had come to have. And I started paying attention to some of these online spaces where people were talking about themselves as ex-evangelicals, and they were talking about what they described as the process of deconstruction or rethinking their faith.
Religion and journalism, you know, are both, as we know, ostensibly about finding truth, and one through faith and trust in deeply felt beliefs, the other from a very different standpoint through healthy skepticism and digging for facts. Did your choice of a career in journalism, especially political journalism, play a role in your deconstruction, shall we say?
If anything, I think it was the other way around. I think I was drawn to journalism in retrospect because I had grown up being told that we had the answers, we knew the answers, we had to confidently promote those answers about you know, the meaning of life, the way to heaven, etc., and also the answers to political questions. You know, as I got older, I mean, I went to an evangelical college, but even during my 4 years there, I was increasingly uncomfortable with some aspects of that. You know, this was during the time of the Iraq War, and I was concerned by what I was seeing there, and just increasingly felt that some things weren't adding up about what I'd been taught. And so I found myself interested in journalism. I'd been interested in it for a long time, loved writing, loved talking to people, and it just seemed like a place where I could be curious, and that curiosity and that desire to understand multiple points of view was actually kind of a feature, not a bug. It was not something to suppress. Questions were not something to suppress or push away. They were something that really were a tool for doing my job. I remember doing a couple of stories in my early years at Nebraska Public Radio that had to do with science. And one of them was about a couple of Ice Age mammoth fossils that had been found in western Nebraska. And it was a really cool story. It was like, I think it was my first national story that went national when I was like 23 or 24. These fossils had been, I don't want to bore you, but they'd been unearthed. And it was like these two mammoths had their trunks twisted together fighting. It was very cool, very unusual. These fossils were 20,000 years old, which isn't even that old geologically. But I remember thinking, wow, you know, I was taught that the Earth is 6 to 10,000 years old. And I knew at this point that this wasn't right. You know, I knew that the overwhelming scientific consensus did not align in any way, shape, or form with creation science as I was taught in school and church. But the first time I wrote something about 20,000 years old in a script, in a story, it felt a little uncomfortable, like, oh, are my parents going to hear this, you know? And so there were moments along the way where I just, you know, I was kind of reminded about how different the world I was raised in was from the world that most people I was encountering in my work were living in.
Cognitive dissonance has become a phrase. Did that play a role in your process?
Absolutely. I mean, just go back to the example of evolution, right? I wanted so badly to believe that the Genesis account of creation was literally true, the way that everybody, I mean, my Christian school textbooks told me this, even my college professors told me this. I describe in the book a seminar that I went to at church as a little kid. And, you know, it was really kind of fun and exciting to think that we had this like special knowledge that nobody else had, and we had this secret truth about the world, and, you know, that God had given us the truth and everybody else was rejecting it, which is what I was told. But it did create cognitive dissonance because, again, my grandfather, who was a neurosurgeon, one of the most educated people I knew, he didn't believe any of this. And, you know, I'd go to museums occasionally and I'd see books at the library and I could tell. It wasn't hard to tell that, like, this didn't line up with the scientific consensus. And that created a lot of confusion in me and a lot of stress. Like, how do I make sense of this when everybody around me is telling me this is true? And I need to believe this. Certainly not all evangelicals are young earth creationists. I want to be clear about that. But there are a lot who are. And I was told that, you know, if you start to question the Genesis account, then you start to question the whole Bible, and then you start to question Jesus, and then you start to question your salvation. And that could lead literally to hell. That created a tremendous amount of anxiety and stress in me as a young person to figure out how to process that.
Can I ask you what you think is next? Does this exodus, this deconstruction continue to grow? Is it generational? At some point, some sort of balance is achieved? Or do you see that younger evangelicals will continue to leave?
I have all those questions too. And, you know, it's not just evangelicals. There's really interesting new data from the Pew Research Center that suggests that there are now more people who identify as nothing at all than who identify as white evangelical or Catholic. And that is really changing the shape of the country, and it's going to, in a country whose politics have been so dominated by religion for so long. I do think, though, and this shows up in the data, people want to believe in something. They want meaning in their lives, and religion has done a decent job of providing that. But I think in an increasingly pluralistic society and a society where there's more information available, like I could go online now and find out that the Earth is not 6,000 years old, it becomes more complicated to sort of navigate the interaction between religious traditions and the outside world, whatever that may be for people. So I don't have the answer to that. It's something I'm very fascinated by, and I think will be a challenge for generations to come. How do you sort of do the work of religion while evolving in, you know, a modern world where we know more than we used to.
Sarah McCammon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was NPR national political correspondent Sarah McCammon talking with AZPM's Duncan Moon about her new book, the Ex-Evangelicals. There is something powerful about a single voice sharing a true story. It gives a chance for the storyteller to let their personality shine, while possibly forging new connections with anyone who listens. In support of this important community tradition, Arizona Spotlight will now feature a different storyteller on the third Thursday of every month. Now here's Tony Paniagua.
Thank you, Mark. Our storyteller this month is Steve Braun, who is originally from the hamlet of Massapequa, Long Island, New York. Braun is an emergency 911 communication center supervisor in Tucson who worked as a professional chef for nearly 30 years before beginning his current career. His story is from an even earlier chapter of his life. As a child, Steve had been in love with dance lessons, but due to conflicting schedules, he had to choose between dancing and baseball. He says societal pressure about boys and dancing forced a decision.
I was a little boy in the early 70s who didn't like playing Little League baseball. In fact, my happiest Little League memory is when my friend Chip executed an unassisted triple play. I was sitting on the bench, distracted by any number of things, except for the baseball game I was supposedly playing in, when I heard the sharp crack of a bat. I looked up in time to see Chip, our shortstop, move toward third and leap what must have been 6 feet into the air to catch the line drive. He seemed to hang in the air for a moment before gently floating down in time to tag the second base runner, who had skidded within reach while trying to stop in the uncooperative dirt. Chip then casually trotted over third base on his way to the dugout for the last out. The runner, who mere moments before thought he was scoring the tying run, was left standing halfway between third and home, shoulders slumped in disappointment. It was an amazing play, and I remember being thrilled for my friend, somewhat happy we had won, and utterly relieved that I didn't have to play baseball anymore that day. If Chip was a triple play threat, I was just a triple threat to my own team. I couldn't hit, couldn't throw, and couldn't catch. In a word, I sucked, and I knew I sucked, and I knew I wasn't getting any better. For my coach, though, I had one saving grace. I was the smallest kid in the league, and no pitcher could strike me out, so long as I didn't swing. I was a sure walk, an almost guaranteed base runner, and I was fast, too. So it was decided that I shouldn't swing, ever. And that was just fine with me. It wasn't, however, fine with my father and my grandfather. "You can't go through life with the bat on your shoulders, Steve," they used to tell me when we did batting practice. Like most of my peers, I looked up to my father and grandfather, and they held sway over me. So at a very young age, I was presented with my first ethical dilemma: to swing or not to swing. Now, for two innings, when the other team was at bat, I was exiled to the pasture that is right field. And except for the paralyzing fear that someone would hit the ball in my general direction, I was pretty happy out there. While the rest of the team was busy playing baseball, I was free to watch everything else around me. The parents on the bleachers, little brothers and sisters playing on the playground, planes up above, and the grass below. Ah, the grass. The various varieties of verdant vegetation. I studied it. All of it. Those flat blades, you know, the normal ones? And the other ones, the round ones, that telescope up with that odd flat blade that sticks out almost horizontal. Not to mention the crabgrass, weeds, and dandelions. Those were the ones that spoke to me. The weird ones. Yes, I felt at home in right field, until someone would notice I wasn't paying attention and would yell, "Look alive out there, Braun!" So I would assume the position, leaning forward with hands on bent knees, and I'd realize this was actually better for observing the grass. So I was happy in right field as long as nobody hit the ball out there, and I was happy at bat as long as I didn't swing at pitches. Many years later, as a philosophy student at the University of Arizona, I realized that this was my first experience in existentialism. I was happy playing baseball as long as I didn't do any of the things that constituted playing baseball.
In case you're wondering, Steve has never gone back to baseball, but his favorite sport as a spectator is ice hockey. Join us on May 16th for another dynamic story from a resident in our region. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Tony Paniagua.
And before we close the show, here's a poem. In the year 2022, Susan Cummins Miller got to combine her love for geology and poetry in creating a chapbook called Making Silent Stones Sing. Here is a reading.
1. Picture Rocks Canyon. Paisley scarlet bandana caught on gray thornbush, sprouting from naked rock. Lavender blooming ironwoods, swift zebra-tailed lizards, and always the cactus wrens for company. 2. If you sit where basalt layers first enter the canyon, clear your mind, focus on nothing, you'll discover a faint figure pecked in black patina, elongated body, arms upraised, feet planted firmly on nothing but ground mass. Nearby, inscribed on other smooth outcrops, circles and loops, squares and rectangles, messages left by archaic writers. How many hundred times have you trudged by without stopping, intent on completing the loop trail, a metaphorical circle beginning and ending in your room? 3. Note to self. If it is the journey that matters and not the arbitrary destination, then remember the magic in this impromptu stop. And before you leave, place your hand on the petroglyphs. Acknowledge the spark leaping artist to artist and making silent stones sing.
That was Susan Cummins Miller reading the title poem from her chapbook, Making Silent Stones Sing. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show is a production of AZPM. The music is by Calexico. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. Production assistance by Alicia Vasquez. I'm producer and host Mark McLemore.
Arizona Public Media's original programming is made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.